Welcome to Odd Trilogies with Logan and Andy. I'm Logan Somosh.
And I'm Andy Carr.
And on Odd Trilogies with Logan and Andy, we usually take a trio of films tied by cast and crew, thematic elements, numerical order, etc. And we take each film and discuss the good, the bad, and the weird surrounding them. But that's not today. Today, we have yet another prequel for you because of this year, of course. We had a bunch of films that had a new entry in some way, shape, or form, whether thematic or in the Kung Fu Panda Godzilla vs. Kong situation, just the next entry. And so we thought to, initially think it was going to be fun, aka maybe just be a glutton for punishment for everyone to listen to. We decided that to, as our possible last prequel, I think it's at least the only one we planned for the rest of the year, or maybe just for a long time.
Yeah, I think this is our last one.
As of now.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think there might be one or two more this year that we could have done it for, but maybe we can just wait and see.
That's true. We'll have to see.
But today, we just decided, since we have literally covered every single film in this man's career.
Yeah.
And, it just wouldn't feel right at
this
point.
We're in too deep. We're in too deep.
We are way too fucking deep when it comes to this man. So. Yeah. Because of that, today we are doing a bit of a twofer for this prequel. We are talking about the entirety of Netflix's Rebel Moon, Zack Snyder's sci-fi epic.
His opus from Zack Snyder.
His second attempt possibly could succeed, but we don't know yet. It's too early on, but it's his second attempt to make a franchise for Netflix.
Right.
His first one was the last time we talked about him, which was Army of the Dead.
Yeah.
In 2021 or was it 2022?
I don't care.
I think just look up Army of the Dead, Zack Snyder. Yeah, you can see the date there. Yeah. But so because of that, we are now talking today about Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, which came out late November, early December last year.
Yeah.
And the recently released by Netflix, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver.
Mm.
Now, you may be wondering, Logan, Andy, this could be a really fun glutton for punishment if you just made two separate episodes about these films.
Right.
Why did you decide to do one together? Well, that is because this was originally supposed to be just a big sci-fi epic single film.
Yes.
That I think about halfway into, at least when they started doing press for, initially for Rebel Moon, they decided to reveal, oh, wait, it's actually a twofer.
Yeah.
You actually get a film, you get basically 4.5 hours of what ultimately would have, could have, honestly, I don't actually think it would have been any better just to have it together in one film, but at the same time, it doesn't make it any worse, so.
It wouldn't have,
really
like,
just depends.
Yeah. I think condensing this into one movie still would have left you with a horrible waste of time.
Yeah.
But it would be like 2 hours less wasted time. I don't think you really gain anything by making it one movie, but you sure as hell don't gain anything by making it two.
Here's the thing about Snyder that I think has been, the reason why we even felt like, because I kind of said we should do this, I believe around the time you were about to see the first film in an early screening or afterwards.
Yeah.
I basically said it because, one, again, we've covered pretty much all of his films. But at the same time, Snyder is one of, honestly, he was kind of like one of our first trilogies we ever did.
Yeah, he's kind of baked into our DNA on the pod.
He was the first Rise of director trilogy we ever did. So in case you don't know this man's career, it's an easy run. He was a commercial music video director in the early 2000s who got his directorial debut in 2004's Dawn of the Dead remake.
Right.
Then after that is 2007's 300. Then 2009's Watchmen, which I would argue is probably his second best film.
Yeah.
And then 2010-2011's Legend of the Guardians, The Owls of Kahul, which I would argue is his best film.
His only animated
film. His only animated film, and honestly his most interesting and probably best film. And then his next film after that is a absolute dumpster fire, but nonetheless interesting, which is Sucker Punch.
Right.
Which
that
we
was
did.
Kind of his, I guess that was his first original film.
That
right?
was his first yeah. original film, because initially we did The Rise of Snyder, which was Dawn of the Dead, 300, and Watchmen. And then we did two separate prequels pertaining to
yeah.
Snyder's only animated film at the time, which was Gahool. And then his only, at the time, original idea, which
yeah.
was Sucker Punch. I'm not saying the man doesn't have original ideas. I'm just saying in terms of putting it on the screen.
IP, in terms of.
IP,
yeah.
yes. And then after that, of course, the reason, the real reason why we wanted to also talk about Snyder is because at the time, the Snyder Cut was going to be a thing. So
right,
we did
right.
his DCEU trilogy, which was Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, and then, of course, his cut of the Justice League, which is most notably known as the Snyder Cut, but it's Zack Snyder's The Justice League.
Yeah, yeah.
And since
yeah, and then,
then...
And then he got his deal with Netflix. We
yes,
developed a
yes.
relationship with Netflix, and
yeah.
that's how we got Army of the Dead, which was kind of meant to be spun off into a multimedia franchise,
it,
including, like, video games and comics and
I do want, yeah.
shorts.
Because
yeah.
we didn't talk about this. I think we talked about it a little bit when that prequel came out. It felt like, it feels like 87 years since
yeah.
we talked about this film. But at the time, I think we did that episode, it was announced that not only was there going to be a prequel series
right.
that was animated,
right.
that was going to have the same cast, this really pertaining to the early years of the zombie apocalypse. Not only was it going to have that, it was also supposed to have a straightforward standard sequel. It was also going to have a spinoff pertaining to the Swedish Safecracker, who
oh, yeah.
basically, I believe, directed that film as well. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because the animated series is canceled, the sequel is not happening, but the spinoff with the Swedish Safecracker actually did fucking happen.
They made it?
They made it. It's
oh.
on Netflix. It
oh.
is called Army of Thieves.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
It has, you know, Game of Thrones alums. It's wild to see a Zack Snyder credit only because it's based off of the characters of Army of the Dead,
right.
technically.
Yeah.
But that film
oh,
came
wow.
out.
Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah.
I'm recognizing it now that I see it. I
yeah.
forgot this happened.
I mean, it's also, it's not a proper Snyder film, so it wasn't
right,
something we're
yeah.
going to talk about, but it's just fascinating to think that all the things that could have just been cut initially, for some reason, the spinoff just existed.
yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. So, from that point on, Netflix already has a deal with Snyder. There are rumors about that there is like a failed, aka old Star Wars plot.
Those rumors had been
script.
Circulating for several years. I want to say since like maybe shortly after Rogue One or something. I feel like I started hearing about
yeah.
this Zack Snyder Star Wars movie idea.
Yeah, because around the time Rogue One comes out, at that point is when we probably still have 2-3 different film ideas that involve, like, I think at that point it's like, you know, the Trank Boba Fett film,
yeah,
the rumors of a Kenobi film, as well as another rumor of like doing something that's Rogue One-esque in terms of like taking a group of people from a different event. Like, there's at that point they're just throwing anything at the wall, and to have a Snyder as Star Wars film, regardless if it's like actually Lucasfilm was interested in that,
right,
or
right.
if another company was doing it. Clearly, that would have gotten a lot of buzz once it did that.
Yeah.
Oh, also Solo, which is, like, out of all the spinoff ones, is probably the one I like the most. But
sure.
That is what it is. But, yeah, it was a rumor going around that Snyder was practically going to make his own Star Wars in some way, shape, or form,
yeah.
based off of an idea that could have been a Star Wars at this point. Again,
well, that was, supposedly actually pitched to Disney and rejected
yes,
or
yes.
something along
which,
those lines.
Which, that I kind of would, if that is, of all the things that is described about the script, if everything was false except for that,
yeah,
I would fucking love to see that pitch. Not because I think Disney would like tear down Snyder for the idea, but I want to see Zack Snyder look a bunch of Disney execs and Lucasfilm execs
yeah.
in the eyes and say, guys, I'm going to do something really wild and different for a sci-fi thing. I'm going to do Seven Samurai in space.
Right.
And then you have probably a Lucasfilm exec being like, does he fucking know that, like, at least...
Dave Filoni's head just falls on
yeah.
the table. Like,
it's like, we have, like, a show in development that's going to have a fucking Seven Samurai. And also, like, the Clone Wars animated series has a Seven Samurai
yeah.
episode. Like, of all the Kurosawa he could fucking rip off, he's going to rip off the thing that Star Wars has already done, I think, a little too much. So, yeah, in case you were like me when we came into, like, watching these films, because basically what piqued my interest around November, December was not only because, you know, we've done all of his films, let's do it, you know, fuck it. When the second one comes out, we'll rip the Band-Aid off. Uh-huh. The real reason why I wanted to watch this is because the adverse reaction that Andy had when he saw it at the screening, because of all the bad films we've watched or we're going to watch for the podcast, I have never seen this man just automatically go, Logan, this is one of the worst things I think I might have ever seen, at least in recent memory.
Mm.
This has nothing of value to it. It might be the worst film I've seen this year.
Yeah.
I'll still do the episode, but I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, in my mind, that only piqued my curiosity more in terms of what it is. Because, again, when you hear something like that, and then you went with our friend Austin, who unfortunately, you know, was on the Monkey Bone episode.
Yes.
That is the lost episode that is just in purgatory. And like,
yeah.
I will hope one day, maybe in Rebel Moon times, I can find the technology to fix that episode and put it back out. But you went with our friend Austin.
Yeah.
And I will not repeat what he said, but I will say it was one of the meanest things I think I've ever heard anyone say about a film and its director.
Yeah.
Which, again, also piqued my interest because, holy shit.
Yeah, it's a strong reaction.
That says a lot. It's a very strong reaction. So, cut to April, where we already have this planned out. We know we're going to do this. And so I'm going, okay, fuck it. I'm going to watch Rebel Moon one night, and then the next night we watch Scargiver together. But I'm going to watch Rebel Moon 1 by myself because I do not want to subject you to watching one again. Also, I know that I could not convince you to watch one again.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe as an experience, I am just going to watch A Child of Fire, which is the first part, and then just live message, live text you and Austin as we went. And initially when I said I was going to live text them, I thought it was just going to be intermittent, you know, every 15, 20 minutes. Maybe I'll just like, you know, I'm fucking texting them. I think each text is at least 2 to 3 minutes between.
Yeah.
I am losing my fucking mind because when the film starts, my brain clicks in a way that makes me go, oh no. Andy, Austin, is this really just going to be Seven Samurai, but before the fun stuff happens? And you both go, yeah. And I go, fuck.
Pretty much it.
And that's the crazy thing about Rebel Moon, is that Rebel Moon not only doesn't really offer much of anything, I think, in either one of these, in either one.
Yeah.
It just weirdly, it just feels so un-Snyder in a way. Because again, this man's career is basically been built off of making wild batshit decisions that are interesting in a foundational level, never really that good, but at least show some creativity in a way where this man clearly thought this was a good idea and is probably surprised that it flopped the way that it did.
Yeah.
And so we're now at a point where we're watching Rebel Moon and neither one of these films have any of that. There's no interesting, like,
there's no big swings.
There's no big swings. Like, that's the weird thing, too, is, like, this man has clearly 100% control.
Yeah, this is the blankest blank check I think he's ever been written.
It is insane to watch this and be like, you had everything in your power to just make the weirdest, un-Star Wars-y Star Wars film that you could ever make, and what you make is, like, genuinely... And I mean this. It's going to sound hyperbolic, but it's genuinely true. This is the type of sci-fi that makes you look at the sci-fi epics that have failed in the past in the last 15 years, maybe even 20 years, and make you go, you know what? We were too hard on that.
Right.
We were too hard on John Carter. We were too hard on Cloud Atlas, Jupiter Ascending, fucking Tomorrowland. Anything that is sci-fi that was supposed to start a franchise or be big budget that didn't work. And we were mean to, even if it did deserve any of kind of the hate
criticism,
that it got.
Yeah.
And the criticism, it still is just automatically, when you put it up against Rebel Moon, it just looks better in comparison.
Yeah, it just
and
kind
of,
it
astounding.
It sets a new floor. It lowers the
really
floor.
Really does.
Yeah.
And it shows that the floor, unfortunately, is not always going to be just like swing and a miss. You're always trying to hit home runs. Like, this feels like a film where you're Like, Snyder's just budding. Like, he's just trying to fill bases and slowly just get to base as with as many people as he can before people just, like, get him out.
Yeah.
Like, he's not swinging for the fences. There's no Martha to this. There's no fucking, like, Doomsday gonna shove this in. There's no emails of the fucking Justice League as the way they introduce the Justice League.
No, it's...
There's no four-hour cut of fucking Justice League.
Yeah. It's just... There's the most banal, uncreative, unexciting, uninspired stroll through familiar sci-fi and adventure beats that you've ever seen. Like, it's just...
It is, yeah.
It's amazing how like we said, this is kind of the blankest check Snyder's ever been written. The most free reign, the most uninhibited he's ever been. And what does he do? He makes the least interesting, least original work he's ever produced.
And decides to be his own director of photography.
Well, that
which
too.
We need to fucking talk about as well. Because again, with Army of the Dead, it kind of makes sense. I think I remember the behind the scenes stuff with Army of the Dead about how just... in terms of the groundedness of a zombie apocalypse, how silly that premise is in terms of, like, we're going to go to Vegas and we're going to steal a bunch of money, which was, like, an epitome of just, like, hellish landscape during the zombie apocalypse. Mm-hmm. That's silly as shit. But, you know, if you really want to ground it, make it feel like you're just on the ground with them as, like, a news team. Even though it's clear there's no news team with them, clearly just kind of get that energy.
Yeah.
And so in Snyder's head, especially like in the, you know, still COVID times, of course he's just going to be like, yeah, I know what I want in my head. It's just easier for me to be my own DP.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Guys, it's 2023 when this first film comes out, 2024 now. He has clearly enough money to fucking hire a director of photography.
Yeah.
Because Jesus Christ, is this film, it just feels so flat. In every way.
I assume he just likes being the guy behind the camera, which I get.
God,
but
I'd
also
hope so.
Like, fucking, maybe, you know, proof your stuff against another opinion.
not even saying, like, yeah, it's not even asking, like, you should get an award winning. Like, no, there's no fucking deacons in this situation. Like, I'm just saying, like, this is the type where it's like, Snyder is the kind of creator where clearly, like, if he liked a director of photography that could just be in this, he could have fucking asked for it and got it.
Yeah.
So it just is shocking to see him do it himself again and just see, you know, when it comes to, you know, the colors, the just how flat everything is, and just the fact that, like, oh my gosh, not, the special effects, again, are not inherently, they're not awful.
No, I mean,
in
honestly,
any way, like, the money is clearly there. That's where the money went.
Yeah.
Is the special effects. And you know what? Good for them. However, the designs to which the special effects are trying to build off of, where it's like weapons,
lazy,
backgrounds,
yeah.
It is the coolest effect, I think, in the first film. Actually, the coolest effect in both films is Anthony Hopkins' robot.
Sure.
Which is basically just like, what if C-3PO was like,
it's
cool and killed people or fought people?
Yeah.
But
it's
like
mystic... Shaman K2SO.
Yeah, and he clearly is like, it's clearly a physical body there, and they're CG'ing over just like the joints and the head and adding Anthony Hopkins' voice afterwards. But like, in terms of like the color coding, in terms of like the lighting aspects of it, it looks very realistic compared to everything else that's in the film, and it's the best looking effects. But at the same time, it makes it even funnier to think that because of that, it's always funny when he shows up for 5 seconds and then leaves for long periods of time.
Yeah.
He is in the first film for maybe a total of 15 minutes.
At best, yeah.
At best. He shows up. He has nothing really going on. He has one scene with a girl that kind of looks like the slain princess of the story.
Yeah.
He kills a guy. And then he's gone until the very end of the first film.
Yep.
And then the second film is just him being like, I don't want to be a part of this fight. And then he's just a part of the fight.
And then he shows up. Yeah.
It doesn't matter. And then he basically says at the end, like, oh, by the way, I have this really important piece of information that I just, you know, didn't say.
Right.
And it's like, God damn it. Like, what the fuck? Why would you do that? Why is the best stuff, like, I mean, I don't know. It just is.
It's, yeah.
I'm flabbergasted by these fucking films. Again.
Yeah, just by the lack of intrigue and inspiration to them. There's just nothing here.
Oh my God.
It's like, I think it's interesting because it's like watching, it's like when you put a movie, like a, you know, 6 out of 10 movie on in the background and you're not paying attention to it and it's just kind of going by. That's what actively engaging with this movie feels like.
I just spilled alcohol all over myself. I'm a wreck right now. I can't handle it.
Like,
that's what this movie's doing to me.
Trying to engage with this movie is impossible because there's just like a wall there and there's no characters that are remotely intriguing. There are no world building concepts are unique or interesting or anything you haven't seen 1,000 times before.
This is actually a good segue because we're just going to go down the rabbit hole every time we talk about just it as a whole.
Uh-huh.
Let's just talk about the characters.
Yeah.
We'll start with just like one by one. The lead in this is Sophia Boutella.
Yeah. Her name's Cora in the movie.
It's Cora. Okay. Yes. She's ex-Imperium, basically.
Yes.
Empire. And she clearly has a past that, in the first film, you can go, I think I know exactly what you did. And guess what? You can guess right, because in the part two, they basically tell you exactly what you think happened and did. She is given pretty much nothing. And all she really has in the second film is a haircut and a love interest.
Mm-hmm.
And both are uninteresting in their own way, including with the love interest. Say his name again because you were practicing it off.
Mikhail Hussman.
Yeah, Steve from Haunting of Hill House. He was in Game of Thrones.
He was the second casting for...
his name is... Danny's like mercenary fuck buddy towards the end of season 6. Yeah. Which is funny because that same character...
Dario,
that's right. He is Dario. He's the second casting of Dario. And the first casting of Dario, Ed Skrein...
is actually our villain.
He's our villain. He's a John Noble.
Atticus
Noble. Sorry, I think John Halo hit my brain as I said it. So just...
John Rebel Moon. That's Sophia Boutella's character's name. John Rebel Moon.
Ed Skrein, who is Noble, and he is probably... one of the only actors that feels like he's giving his role any kind of sauce, but not because there's anything there, but just because he is just evil Nazi man.
Yeah, and he gets the opportunity to chew scenery.
He really does. And he is just evil for the sake of evil. Jaiman Hansu plays an old general that is basically stuck in like a Colosseum gladiator-esque scenario.
Well, yeah, basically everybody else that we're going to name here.
Cora
winds up on this moon with this little farming village and finds out that the Imperium is going to come and pillage the village for all their grain.
For their grain.
Because for some reason, this all-powerful fascist government with Star Destroyers and interstellar travel needs this one moon's grain because they can't produce that on their own.
It wouldn't even be enough.
Yeah, right. It's enough grain for one village, and for some reason the Imperium needs it. So anyway, Cora basically thinks to herself, and is like, oh, yeah, I know some people I could go talk to, and basically goes about setting up a team to protect this village, which it's the plot of Seven Samurai.
It's even sillier than that though, Andy, because what she goes, hey, I think I might know someone who can lead me to people that'd be interested.
Right, yeah.
And then that guy goes, hey, I think I might know some people who are interested in this kind of fight.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the movie, as in 80% of the movie, is just them finding other people to join the crew, watching them do their thing, and you go, how do they meet these people? How does Charlie Hunnam, who is the one that basically leads them, to
the Han Solo?
Yeah, with a very odd accent for a man that can do accents.
Yeah.
He basically is like this. He is the Rick Flag from David Ayer Suicide Squad, but not as fun.
Yeah.
You don't. I mean, I honestly think Rebel Moon would have maybe gotten a half star more for me if it just had Joel Kinnaman explaining to me who each person was and what their backstory is.
Yeah.
You get that in the first film, but
this is Nemesis, Cyborg Swordmaster. She'll slice you in two.
You don't want to mess with her. Yeah,
don't touch her blades.
Yeah, her kids are dead.
Yeah, her blades will suck you into a black hole.
Like, it's, again, it is, they go to, the first person they run into is, oh my god, he's the one that he handles the hippogriff. Griffin guy, but yeah. You know who I'm talking about.
Tarak.
They show up there.
Doesn't matter.
The guy goes, actually, he's under my indentured servitude.
Yeah, he's basically a slave.
Yeah, I'll let him go if he can tame this griffin, basically. And so it leads to a prolonged scene of a griffin being tamed. They come back. Yeah. He tells the griffin, I guess, via mind contact in terms of just, like, you know, knowing the animal, to kill the slaver.
Yeah.
Which he does as they're leaving the ship.
Right.
Or leaving the planet. The next person is Nemesis, I believe.
Sure.
And Nemesis, they just, again, they find her, they go down an elevator, and they just watch her fight a spider woman, like a genuine...
Like a upper body of a woman, lower body of a spider.
Played by Jenna Malone.
Yeah.
An actual actress that I really enjoy, and I love it when she gets weird. And this time I was like, cool, you're getting weird. But how the fuck did you get these guys to come down with you and not do anything? Because Cora doesn't do anything in this stuff. Charlie Hunnam's character doesn't really do anything. The love interest jumps in to save a kid once, because apparently the spider queen or the spider woman is just eating kids or killing kids because she lost her own children.
Yeah.
And then Nemesis goes, I used to have children too, I get it. And but you can't do that. And then he fights her. With their not lightsabers.
Yeah.
They're like stupid.
Super heated
obsidian
blades
steel
or something
like that. It doesn't fucking matter. They're worse lightsabers.
Yeah.
They have weird, like.
They leave like light trails and.
Yeah, it's like dry ice, like kind of.
It was like a. Yeah, it was a vapor effect.
Yeah,
around
and it's,
them.
Yeah, and the first time they're shown, it's like a Imperium soldier slashes a woman in the back, so you don't fully see the sword. They don't make it any kind of fanfare when that shows up. But there's Nemesis, there's Tarak, there's Jaimon Hansu, who's the gladiator, who's like an ex-general who lost his men.
General Titus.
Yeah, because he just didn't want to do what the Imperium wanted to do, because I don't know if you know this, but the Imperium bad. They'll make that pretty clear initially, and they'll keep reminding you as if uniforms don't make it pretty
literal
goddamn
1940s
clear.
Nazi uniforms aren't clear enough.
Which is the biggest fucking thing that's weird about this film is that the design...
The whole thing is so, like, early 20th century coded.
The fact that, like, the fucking village that Cora is based at, Cora and her love interest, who Andy referred to in the second film as the cream giver.
Yeah, well, they have sex.
Well, they have sex. So. And honestly, it's better than I think whatever his, because I'm just going to probably call him Sam or Seth, because it just feels like...
Gunner.
Gunner.
Yeah.
That's not any better, think, in this... But where Gunner and Cora are from, like, their whole village is built like it's like a set from the Northmen, except they all have sliding doors.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it's the super primitive, like, early 20th century, late 19th century,
like,
village. Everybody's wearing, like, you know, old newsboy hats and corduroy overalls and shit like that. And then they've got, automatic sliding doors on their wood shacks.
And they don't have horses, but they have, like, these weird, clearly horses with masks on. That are just like these weird, just like, I can't even remember how to describe it. Because every time I looked at it, I was like, it's just a horse.
Yeah.
Just be a fucking horse at this point. Why are you pretending that
it's
like got
mandibles?
They don't
commit hard enough to make it look like not a horse.
No.
It's literally just a horse in a mask.
Yeah. And it just doesn't, it's such weird design across the board. It seems like, because again, like Star Wars, not saying that Star Wars
did that, but they did that in 1977.
Yeah, but they also did it even more interesting though, because at least it's like, why is there like an igloo type thing in this desert?
Sure. Well, it's like, so at least foreign. It's so foreign that it's like, okay, I don't even know what this technology is.
Well, is Rebel Moon just like
an actual 18th century European shack with an automatic Walmart door on it? Like, because, I don't understand.
Like, Rebel Moon has this whole...
These people don't have any technology or any electricity.
But when they do, it's like out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's just like they then have electricity. They have laser guns.
They're still using windmills and shit. I know. Shit. Like, why?
It doesn't fucking make sense.
Yeah, they're churning their own butter.
Like, literally, there's a whole long extended sequence at the end of one where it ultimately leads to this could have just been a Skype call.
Yeah,
where Ed Skrein's character John Hancock, Rebel Moon Noble, basically tells the head the Emperor the new, he's not the Emperor, but he basically, they killed the Emperor and the Queen, and then this guy took over saying, "Oh God, it sucks. Whoever killed the Queen and Emperor, well, I'll fill that spot, for a second." And that guy, who really is not intimidating, nor is he in the film in any way.
No.
He's not a bad actor either. Again, that guy is from Hawkeye. He's like the one guy in the Russian tracksuit mafia that is like kind of, you know, has some depth other than comedic relief. And it just is fascinating just to see all these like tubes and liquid of different colors go into like this little sack to basically put Ed Skrein into a mind meld that could have just been a fucking hologram, because that's all it should have been. At a certain point, it's clear a lot of the design choices are basically, we don't want to do what Star Wars would have done in this scenario, or we don't want this to look like a Star Wars world. But at the same fucking time, gonna be honest, just because a cantina just looks like a Wild West saloon doesn't mean I'm not gonna look at it and look at weird aliens inside of it and be like, this is the cantina scene from A New Hope. This is the part where this happens, and oh my God, is that Ray Fisher? That's Ray Fisher. He's Blood Axe.
Yeah.
First Blood name Axe. I don't remember.
Darian?
Dariax.
Darius?
Is it Dariax? Blood Axe?
I don't think it's Dariax.
I fucking hope.
Blood Axe.
I would love it if it was Dariax.
Darian, yeah.
Darian Blood Axe, because in this film...
And his sister Devra.
Devra and Darian. Because in this film, the rebellion is the Blood Axes.
Yeah, they have already begun a rebellion.
Yeah, and it's pretty fucking big, but they're also not great at hiding. I will probably say, because they know where they're... It seems like they know where their like trail leads most times. But basically, Korra and Gunnar are like, Well, Gunnar, I think at one point goes like, yeah, I've worked with the Blood Axes before. Maybe we could find them. And then Hunnam goes, hold on. We still got 45 minutes until you should maybe find them. Let's go find other fun little goodies, little fun little goof guys to just hang out with. And that leads to the rest of the fucking team, because if it's going to be seven samurai, you got to have seven people.
Yeah.
And guess what? They certainly end on seven people being like, yep, that is probably going to be the seven that fight in this fight. Cool.
Yeah.
And that's about it. Like, it's again, it is... We say this all the time, but you know, when we talk about episodes, we're like, how long are we gonna be able to talk about this for like over an hour? And 9 times out of 10, it's usually when we say that it becomes some of our longer episodes. Yeah. Case in point, God's Not Dead was nearly 2 hours.
Yeah,
and we were not expecting that in any way.
Kind of thought we'd be struggling to fill time on that one.
And here we are, pretty much done explaining the first film and talking about its characters, except for, you know, Charlie Hunnam betrays the team.
He has his little traitor arc and then gets a pneumatic hammer through the head.
Yes, which is fun to a degree, I guess. Doesn't mean
sure it'll be more fun in the director's cut, because in this one we cut around all the violence because this is the contractually obligated PG-13 cut. Stay tuned, I guess, for the Snyder cut later this year.
Yeah, let's just talk about it. It is the other thing that really kills the fucking vibe of these two films, and why we would recommend, even if it wasn't for the fact that both these films are dog shit and useless and you really shouldn't give them a time of day, even if you still were kind of interested in watching these films, we still would not recommend you try it until at least August, because it pretty much sounds like that what these two films are inferior versions of what Snyder was basically, like, Snyder was basically told by Netflix, we would like you to have, like, a director's cut.
Yeah,
like,
well,
in your contract, we need you to have, like, because clearly...
I'm sure on Netflix's side, it was, you know, it's this kind of manufactured attempt to recreate the Snyder Cut Justice League hype. And Netflix is like, oh, people love when Snyder gets to, you know, release a director's cut, and Snyder loves when he gets to release a director's cut. So, hey, guess what, Snyder? Before you even start shooting this movie, plan to shoot for a PG-13 version and your unrated version. So Snyder actually shot this movie with the intent, like, knowing, okay, I'm going to basically make two versions of this movie.
Yeah, because all the trailers for Rebel Moon just scream, like, yeah, this isn't your daddy's Star Wars. People can fuck in this universe.
That is the whole appeal, as far as I can tell, of these movies, at least in concept. It's Star Wars, but it's more violent, more vulgar, more horny, more quote-unquote adult. You know, if that's something you've always wanted from Star Wars, then God help you, but this is what that's going to be. And then you watch these versions of it, and it's 100% not that, because it's totally kneecapped and neutered.
It's as adult as, like, a scantily clad woman in a, like, a Viking being spray-painted on the side of a van. Like, there's just, like, oh, wow, that guy's very muscular, and that woman's got very little clothes. Oh, my God.
And she has a look in her eyes.
Oh, my Lord. Like,
and do they even say fuck in either of these? I don't
know. No, because it's PG-13.
Well, yeah, but you get one fuck in a PG-13.
I don't even think he commits to that. Yeah. I think at a certain point, and if anyone said it, it was Corey Stoll. And yeah, I don't remember if he said
Corey
it or
Stoll's
not.
Corey Stoll's character who's around for like 10 minutes and then dies in the first.
Which was shocking. I was like, wow, you got to sell Corey Stoll in a role and you just,
Snyder,
you waste him. You
Snyder
waste Stoll.
Must just be the most charismatic man in Hollywood and
he
a pleasure to
is.
Work with, because the names he gets to do nothing in this movie or these movies, incredible.
I wish they still, I think it was an old College Humor bit. College Humor doesn't exist anymore, and that's totally fine because Dropout fucking rolls. But there was a one bit where it was like, you know, this actor's, the perspective of this actor's agent, and I think there's like a Nicolas Cage episode, and that. I really, if that was still around today, I would love a Ray Fisher agent episode.
Oh, man.
Because, my God, I think Ray Fisher is very charismatic as a person.
Sure.
I think it's fun to listen to him talk about the projects he's in, especially when he's invested and likes, like, he likes Snyder. And also, like, watching the Snyder cut, it was clear of, like, yeah, there's something that this guy has in this role of Cyborg that, like, I would like to actually see him in a good movie as something.
Yeah.
And to watch Rebel Moon, yet again, give Ray Fisher a chance to shine, and they give him nothing, and then they fucking kill him.
Yeah. And And, you know, Snyderites, Snyderlings, Snyder Chads,
good Lord,
whatever you are, you know, we are aware of Snyder's claims that his version, his director's cut, is a wildly different experience. I think he basically said it's pretty much a whole different movie. So we will see how those promises, you know, are fulfilled.
But as of right now.
As of right now, he knew he was making two cuts, and he still turned out this.
And also,
it's not like Netflix took this movie from him, like Justice League. You know,
again,
it's not like he, you know, had to make a bunch of compromises in post. He knew this was happening.
Yeah.
He made this movie.
Yeah.
This may not be his idealized version, but he made this movie.
It feels like this film, both these films are a bit of a challenge from Netflix to him in terms of, like, listen.
Yeah.
You know, you can make it however you want it to do, but we think that, like, you know, we would like you to make a more quote-unquote sanitized or more approachable version, but we'd also like you to not hold back so that if you have enough and you want to go for an unrated, you can do it, but not outright say because they want the Snyder Cut praise.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, if you want if you want the Snyder Cut praise, wait until July to say that Zack Snyder has been kicked out and Joss Whedon's doing the new cut.
Yeah. Well, and I'm
bring back Joss Whedon into a fucking Snyder project. That will get really people excited.
Yeah, I'm sure Netflix also though is covering their bases with this because they wrote Snyder a blank check with Army of the Dead. They told him, hey, we'll franchise this shit. We'll make it massive. Comes out, nobody really cares about it. It's not critically successful.
No.
Nobody particularly likes it. And they're like, you know, they're probably a little burned by that. So they're like, okay, Snyder, your next thing, sure, you can have free reign, but you're also going to, you know, make a slightly more...
Because
appealing version.
The biggest issue with making films that are directly only for streaming is the fact that, like, when you're making a film for the theater, you have to have the mindset of people sitting in the theater being like, this is going to be the point where, like, if they're even thinking about doing a bathroom break, this moment's going to keep them on their seat. You want to keep people in their fucking seat. While as with most streaming films, you have the ability to pause at any time.
Yeah,
they don't care about, like, financially how to get the money back because it counts on views.
Yeah.
And even how that even pertains doesn't even matter to us because we never fully get the information in terms of what Netflix considers, you know, such and such. Everything's a success to Netflix the way they talk about all the stuff they have.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating to watch a director who clearly, like, excelled in a way – in the mindset of, like, this is going to look cool on the big screen in front of, like, a lot of, you know, people in the theater, to a point where it's like both Army of the Dead and these two films just don't have the energy of, like, yeah, this is going to be the moment where people go fucking nuts. Like, Rebel Moon, I guess, I mean, technically has more of attempts at that, but even then, they just feel so moot in comparison to, like, even the most lackluster of sci-fi films that were made for theaters.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no intention there. That there's a different intention there compared to, like, if it was theatrical only.
Yeah. And I don't know how much, you know, I can't really speak to how much Snyder would actually be keeping in mind, like, how people are going to be watching this movie as he's making it. But, you know, there is something to be said for, you know, when you're making a movie for the theatrical audience, you know, the audience is kind of your instrument and they're your orchestra and you're playing them.
Yeah.
You know, your movie is, you're making them laugh in this moment and then gasp and then shriek and cry. And, like, you know, you're trying to time all these reactions in a way that creates an interesting experience for the audience. And like you said, with streaming, you don't have that obligation because half the stuff on streaming, that's generous, way more than half the stuff on streaming is just there to, like, be played mindlessly in the background of whatever else you're doing, or something you can half pay attention to while you scroll on your phone or make dinner or entertain your kids.
Yeah, because most conversations about what is big on a streaming service usually is Netflix goes, this was watched by 75, 100 million households, not this fucking thing, but, like, in general, like, they're bigger stuff.
Yeah.
And then someone goes, okay, how does that mean, like, retention wise that 20 million,
like, they watched the whole thing?
Yeah, like 100 million households watched all of it, or, like, you know, if it's a TV series, is there, like, can you see a cutoff point? And then that's the point where Netflix goes really silent.
Yeah.
And goes, well, at least it was, there 100,000 minutes were shown, like 100,000 minutes were watched of this show. Yeah. And it's like,
well, and I think timely enough, I think it was just in the last couple of weeks, Netflix announced they would not be revealing any, like, watch data anymore.
Because it's, again,
or subscriber data.
Which is understandable because subscriber data,
they don't really stand to gain anything.
No, because they're going to lose. Like, because most streaming services, when there's usually a bump, there's usually right after a big drop, and it kind of goes ebbs and flows, especially with big releases. And also with watch data, it's because everyone's had the same question about, like, yeah, but, like, why is what, at what point do you go, oh, yeah, this person, like, The Rock has had this many minutes watched on Netflix, let's give him a $60 million film or $100 million, like, with Chris Evans or some shit. And it's like, what? How do you even engage that this is even going to make its money back?
Yeah, I can't even begin to, like, wrap my head around how you define success in an environment like Netflix. Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, if there is... Netflix is like the streaming service that, you know, everybody has. That or Disney Plus. Like, if there's one streaming service that almost everybody who streams stuff has, it's Netflix or Disney Plus. Netflix has been around longer.
And Disney Plus has nostalgia as its backing, as well as,
and
like,
so when you are,
some of the best deals in the streaming, like, package-wise.
Yeah, and so when you're Netflix, who is rooted, you know, you are kind of a foundational platform of streaming. Everybody already has Netflix. I don't really understand. You're no longer probably judging on, like, how much a new movie increases your subscriber count.
Yeah.
Because most people already have Netflix, you know. Like,
in my head...
I don't understand how you define, you know, in views doesn't really matter because you don't make money on views. You already have those people's money because they have Netflix.
Yeah, you can't even tell. Yeah, it's like, it genuinely is like, in my head, if you can't even guess, like, if the financials are not, like, the point you push, the most standard thing then after that is hype, critical acclaim, and then awards recognition. Because I think, like, the fact that Netflix as a company, you know, again, the reason why they've existed for so long is they literally release so much shit every month for completely different genres, for completely different demographics.
Yeah, they cater to everyone.
They just cater to everyone, and they cater to no one at the same time, and that's why they've existed for as long as they have and why they're still the king of what they do, or queen, whatever you see Netflix as an entity. More like a Hydra Spectre-esque control.
An Arnim Zola.
Yes, and arguably, like, in my head, I think of the fact that it's kind of fucking insane that it's like, you could put The Gray Man, both Rebel Moons, fucking all these, like, all these different Netflix films, and then put All Quiet on the Western Front, which was, like, the best winner for, like, foreign language film last year, and that was one of my favorite films of last year, and that is a Netflix original, technically.
Yeah.
And it was, like, and it won awards, it had acclaim, but it only led to that. I think now if you look at On Quiet on the Western Front, it now just has basically the equivalent of a plaque on its, like, you know, descriptor.
Uh-huh.
That's all it really gets.
Yeah.
And that's,
I mean, like,
just
the last,
that's some boring dystopia shit.
It is interesting how they are kind of, playing both fields. Like, they are, you know, they're absolutely built for the masses, shoveling out reality shows and kind of, you know, run-of-the-mill rom-coms and stuff like that. And then, like, the last two David Fincher films are Netflix originals.
Fincher,
you
fucking
know?
Coen Brothers.
Coen Brothers, Noah Baumbach, like,
Beasts of No Nation, which was an interesting
film. Yeah, all these...
Cary Fukunaga, like, that was...
All these awards darling, auteur-driven things, and it's like... I mean, you know, that's the thing I am most, I guess, grateful for Netflix for, is for being a reliable platform for those voices.
No, for sure. I mean,
because, you know, a lot of even big name auteur directors have spoken out recently about feeling like, I don't feel like I have a guarantee that my movie can get made anymore like it used to be.
No, I mean, fucking Richard Linklater, like, who's made, you know, phenomenal films in his past. He's fucking made the Before trilogy, which is like
School of Rock too.
Yeah, School of Rock, and one of my favorite films of all time, Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
Like, that man clearly, like, he's got a new film coming out on Netflix, and it's clear it's because, like,
nobody else wants it, I guess.
I
or
guess.
Nobody else is gonna give him the money he needs to make.
Which is, again, it just
Martin
shows
Scorsese made a Netflix film.
Yeah, let's fucking talk about that. The fact that even Scorsese has to either go to Netflix or to Apple to get his films produced. This is what the Rebel Moon episode has become, because there's nothing
more interesting
to fucking talk about.
Yeah.
Because Rebel Moon is just the epitome of what you think a streaming blockbuster, quote unquote, would be. Where it's like, when you are not, because again, a blockbuster had that name because it literally had people around the block basically tiring out spots.
Yeah, it was a blockbuster
because
people were excited for it.
And when it comes to now, when you think of what a streaming, like a quote unquote streaming blockbuster is, none of those films feel like they could even do a quarter of the fucking lines that the old school films do.
Well, even calling it a streaming blockbuster, it just speaks to exactly what this film feels like. It's literally not a blockbuster. It's just an amalgamation of moments and character tropes and plot devices that you associate with blockbusters. It's like the kind of the closest thing that a human being, a human auteur could make to an AI film.
It's like blockbusters for dummies.
Yeah.
Like, it really is just taking, like, the chapter sets. And also, yeah, again, it just fucking shows, because it's weird to see. It honestly is just so baffling to see Rebel Moon 1 and 2 come out the way that it has. And then at the same time, a month ago, fucking watch Dune Part 2 and see an auteur just, like, really risk it with a fucking company that right now is not making a lot of great decisions with their own kind of properties, but still made a risk that has ultimately worked in his favor, because he's made one of the best, literally in the span of a month, we have gotten one of the best modern sci-fi epics and one of the worst modern sci-fi epics. And it is just fascinating to see that one of them works, because it's a director who knows that the theater experience really does add to hype, critical acclaim, financials. Like, it clearly works if you really commit to the theater experience, even in a time where, like, there are still people who are like, I get it. The theater experience is not the best for everybody. That's totally fine. And I think the appeal of Netflix still, decades, like a decade plus later, makes perfect sense. I love how available streaming is.
Yeah.
That being said, there is some films, and even smaller films, they're just films in general, where it's just like, you gotta see this in theaters. Because when you don't have your own distractions, and you're not sitting in the most comfortable setting, but you're still, like, you're sitting in comfy seats, but you're not at your house.
Yeah.
When you're almost kind of feel
fully
like
relaxed.
It feels like an event in some way, shape, or form. Whether and it doesn't feel like a fucking event when you watch Rebel Moon. One or two.
And I don't think, I mean, I got to see the first Rebel Moon in the theater.
Yes,
because they screened it for us.
That.
They did not screen part two.
What a shocker.
In fact, I think, like, altogether, the marketing push for part two was basically non-existent compared to how hard they were pushing part one. I think that probably speaks to how part one performed.
Because Snyder talks about, like, I think when part one's coming out, he's like, I want to make six films. And now when...
They did a whole press tour. There's tons of trailers out. I saw it all over the place. Theatrical screenings for press. And then part two just kind of appears.
They go, we're so
Netflix.
Happy to release some comics in the next few weeks to talk about Tarek's backstory.
At this point, I fully expect the Snyder cuts, when those come out, to just be like surprise drops. Like, no fanfare, no announcement, just like,
at this point,
they're out.
I mean, yeah, I think that's another thing, too, that I think really hurts. What really hurts the... hype and the excitement about anything on a streaming service, especially in a Netflix situation, that Netflix's schedule, its release schedule, just moves shit around and doesn't tell anybody. Another film that came out this year that was, I think, literally supposed to come out last year and was announced a year and a half prior to that was fucking Damsel, the Millie Bobby Brown fantasy film, where, like, because every year Netflix early on in the year releases like a sizzle reel of all that's coming out.
Right.
And they just show a sizzle reel of, like, you know, they show a single shot of like Millie Bobby Brown.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly not 11. So it's like, okay, cool. There's a fucking film with her in it and it's fancy, cool. Then you hear nothing.
Right.
And then then if you're interested in, or you're just curious about this film, you look up and then you find articles that came out 4 months prior being like, it's supposed to come out this time. And then you look at the schedule and you go, that's like 2 days from now.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? Like, again, one of my favorite films of last year that didn't make my top 10 that I really, really enjoyed was They Clone Tyrone, which was another situation where that's a Netflix original that was supposed to come out in 2022 initially. And then there was no fanfare until 2023 when it got a new trailer, and they didn't even acknowledge the fact that it's been like 9 months in between. Yeah. They just keep moving shit around, and they did that with Rebel Moon. It literally was Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon will come out this time.
Yeah.
2 months before it was that. Zack Snyder's Rebel Moon Part 1 will come out this time. Part 2 will come out 5 months from now. And then people just go like, Well, what the fuck are you talking about? Wait, it's two films now? Yeah. One's called Scargiver? What the fuck does that even... Wait, and it's... Hold on. What? What? And then the films, yeah. And then, like, it just... It's just shocking. It always... It's like, again, it makes it fun, I guess, to a degree, because you're like, you never know what Netflix is going to put its interest into.
Right.
But at the same time, it's like, I should never... I don't think any Netflix exec or any kind of person should be surprised when people go, like, that's out?
Oh, that came out?
Yeah. That's out? Like, okay. Like, I mean, again, it just is so fucking fascinating to just, like, think about the context surrounding these two films, and then you watch these two films, and they are the blandest fucking things you could even ever see in a sci-fi scenario. Genuinely.
Yeah.
There is nothing that Star Wars has done post-bought out by Disney that is this fucking bad. In fact,
yeah,
I still...
This, I mean, honestly, you know, say everything you want about Disney, you know, being woke and catering to the, you know, the masses or whatever. Like, there is nothing this uncreative in Disney Star Wars.
Yeah, because
everything they've made has more heart, more creative flair, more originality
yes.
to it than this does.
And you were, and that is coming from people, again,
because
I agree,
greatly disliked several.
Who are not yet
Star Wars things.
We become less fans of Rise of Skywalker, and we're not really fans to begin with of that film, but less interested in that film on a rewatch as
yeah.
time goes on. We both don't really like the Kenobi show.
Oh well, yeah, or Boba Fett.
I was so disappointed with Boba Fett, the fact that that show, I enjoyed how that show started, and then
yeah,
when it basically
yeah,
just shits the bed. And the Bad Batch, you know, is a show that exists, it just finished its run, and it's so sad that it only got 6 episodes in one season. Just kidding, I know it got 3 seasons, but most people don't talk about it because it's just a show that exists.
It just
like
came
again
out, yeah.
As someone who is like genuinely was like when Andor came out, had a come to Jesus moment and be like, oh, finally something that I like from this that it like is beyond
yeah.
like a 7 out of 10
yeah.
to a degree. I will say I would take all of that. All of my issues with like Disney Star Wars shit, and I would take that any day over whatever the strengths of Rebel Moon Part 1 and Part 2 are. Because
what are
those
the strengths?
The strengths, I guess, is the fact that, like, the actors, like, I guess certain actors in both films, usually Screen or Hansu, like, the actors that clearly are just like, we're just going to have fun with this.
Yeah.
There's not really much here. Like,
but
I mean,
the fun doesn't translate.
No.
Like,
I think the attempt...
It's not infectious. Yeah.
I mean, the attempt is, like,
sure,
what translates,
sure.
Where it's, like, Jaimin clearly just, like, when he shows up, he is just... He's like, has a beer belly for, like, one scene, and then he gets fit, and then he
yeah.
teaches... He does the classic Seven Samurai. Here's some sticks.
Yeah.
Let's make sure we have
some traps
yeah,
for
like,
these Star Destroyers.
Yeah, and, like, there's all this shit, and there's also, like, one scene where Noble goes on a wild little massacre...
Yeah.
And it's like, okay. And then also, Anthony Hopkins' robot does some shit in the second film where it's like,
yeah,
this could have been...
Yeah, some cool action.
Like, yeah, and again, he has antlers on, and that kind of is cool, but, like,
right.
again, that is the
it's
difference.
All, like, the only remotely good things about this are all superficial.
Yeah.
They're all
it
cosmetic
is,
or aesthetic.
It really says a lot when I hear, because, again, it's always like, the most curious thing you could do, especially when it comes to a Snyder film, is go like, I want to know what Reddit is saying. Because Reddit could go either way. And like Scargiver was fascinating because Scargiver was the film that most people who were disappointed with Child of Fire were just saying, oh, this is what I wanted Child of Fire to be.
Well, more action.
Yeah, more action. But even then, like it barely is
it's
any
still
more action.
It's still a whole hour of characters re-explaining
yeah.
their backstories to you. That's what the first hour of this movie is. They
and
sit
I don't
around
give
a table.
Fuck.
They sit around a table and go, "What's your origin?"
There's more fucking action in Bug's Life. That's
yeah.
a better Seven Samurai adaptation than this fucking thing is.
Yeah.
And again, you know what's great about Seven Samurai? If someone out there hasn't watched Seven Samurai, spoiler alert. Fucking rules, but at the same time, it's a 3-hour film where guess what? The stakes are it is literally 7 dudes that are good at what they do and a town of people that don't know what they're doing, and you are slowly watching these fucking guys die because guess what? There's 7 dudes with villagers
against
that are slowly
an army, yeah.
Yeah. And guess who fucking dies in Rebel Moon of the Seven Samurai? Fucking Nemesis.
Yeah.
The one actress, Bai Duna, who we both have loved in other things, a.k.a. the host from the Rise of Bog episode. Like, she's fucking great in that film. She's also great in the first of that trilogy as well. Barking Dogs Never Lie. Yeah, Never Bite. Like, she's great in that, too. But, like, she has very little to do in this film. She clearly is pushing, in both films, she's clearly pushing a tragic, you know, but, you know, sad angle, but in a way that it's not off-putting. Like, clearly, she is just, like, loves kids and loved being a mother, but lost her fucking kids. So, like, there's a tragic angle to that. But she fucking dies in the most just, way possible. And the fact that no one else dies, where it's like, you just look at the sea of people that's still alive, and I'm like, I'm sick that every one of you are still fucking standing.
Yeah.
Even you. It was like, Tarek, you should have fucking died 20 minutes
ago. Cream Giver dies.
Cream Giver dies, but he dies in the dumbest way, too.
Yeah.
He dies after a Star Destroyer, sorry, not Star Destroyer, has already flipped around this way and that way. All this wild shit has happened. It's like internal damage to a degree. It is just, it just is, their romance is nothing. If the sex scene is fucking 20 minutes long, that still doesn't make it any interesting. It probably is, just because it's just like, well, at least Zach is trying something, even if it's not working at all. Like, again,
at least we're delivering on the idea of something you wouldn't see in a Star Wars movie.
No, I mean, he apparently, like, again, Snyder is just like, I think if he's unfazed by, like, the reception, both, like, critically and viewership wise, that doesn't surprise me, because the way he talks about these director's cuts are like, yeah, these were always going to happen. These are going to happen later this year. And also, he seems more excited to talk about, like, how this death is more graphic and goes more in detail like this. Or, like, he talks about the sex scene that is, there's no sex scene in 2, but clearly it's like,
there's a cut to after the sex scene.
Which is, again, fine. But it's also, like, you know, in Snyder, it's like, again, this is the man that, like, had a whole Dark Shadows, you see Gerard Butler's ass cheeks and Lena Headey naked, like this sex scene in 300. Like, this guy clearly is like, there's got to be something in the fucking director's cut. And it's like, then at some point he's like, I think I shot stuff where, like, Gunner is teaching her how to be more intimate. And I'm like, oh my fucking God, that's what we're gonna fucking watch. It is just fascinating to see that this, I think both films put together, is like $150 million total.
Cool.
I think it's like 80, 75 each, maybe around that time. Which, again, you know, I guess is less than like what a Star Wars film would cost. But even even then, it shows. Like, you can see that where the money is going, and it's not in the right spots.
Most of the guns look like Nerf guns that they spray painted.
Fucking, there's like a bounty hunter like crew that's like, they look like dog creature pig things. They just look like Joel Edgerton orc from fucking Bright. Another Netflix quote unquote blockbuster that just fucking did nothing.
Yeah.
Because, well, that film has a lot of fucking issues.
Well, and that was, but even that that was another auteur's Star Wars. That was supposed to be Max Landis's Star Wars.
And David Ayer post Suicide Squad. Fairy lives don't matter today.
Right.
That has, the fact that Will Smith says that in that film, and now just post slap anything going back to Will Smith. And that, again, I wonder how many of you out there that are listening to this, when we said Bright just had a Manchurian Candidate, like, God, that movie came out. Yeah, that movie was also a Netflix original. They just, the thing that is the benefit of Netflix is the fact that they are churning things out so fast, and it clearly seems they're not making a huge loss, that they can just, like, push it away. They can keep going. And when it comes to, like, their big hits, they can put them up on a pedestal for a few months and then take it down. Like, I mean, like, right now it's like people talking, like, Rebel Moon 1 and 2 have been out. They're together. You can watch the whole story as of right now, the beginning of the story. And most people want to fucking talk about Baby Reindeer, the fucking series that is, like, from the guys that did End of the Fucking World. That is, like, the stalker show that's based off a true story. Like, I have heard more people talk about that than, like, even remotely about.
Yeah, barely any fanfare over Scargiver.
Yeah, and it's understandable as to why. Creamgiver, yeah. Well, it's understandable why, because, again, it's like, at least it was really cool when the few years back we did the Fear Street trilogy.
Yeah.
How they did that, like, every month or just, like, every 2 weeks. They had a new film, and it was like, and, like, again.
Was that Netflix?
Yes, that was Netflix. Because what originally it was supposed to be. But even then, it shows that originally it was supposed to be, I believe, the trilogy. It was technically a Netflix original because they bought the rights, but it wasn't built as such. The original thing was going to be there was supposed to be theatrical releases with 3 months in between each release.
Okay, yeah.
And then instead of that, Netflix, I believe, did 2 weeks between each release.
Yeah, it was definitely less than a month.
And clearly, like, it was still, the films were still a lot of fun. We both really enjoyed going through the Fear Street trilogy. Especially just like with the watch through was just a really fun time. But even then it's like, yeah, the retention rate on like each film goes down really fast, especially when initially, because it's like you give two people only 2 weeks to really find out about this film.
Yeah.
And then the next one's out.
I mean,
there's a reason why the fucking Kevin Costner two-part epic is like got 3 months in between.
An American Saga, or whatever it's called.
An American Saga. Like it's, There is a benefit, and it, again, for streaming services, clearly they understand the benefit of having time in between stuff because there's some streaming services that still do weekly episodes instead of full season drops. Yeah. But even then, it's like they still just don't commit to the fact that like maybe it's best if we don't do it like this or that. Honest to God, I think the closest Netflix has done that, or it's going to be, is that, like, the final season, it literally today as we're recording, I know we always record live, quote-unquote, but as of today when we're recording, they announced, like, the last season of the fucking Karate Kid Cobra Kai show.
Yeah.
And they're putting, like, 3 months in between. They're, like, they're saying it's 15 episodes. They're doing 3 5-episode drops.
Oh.
And it's going to be, like, late summer, late fall, and then 2025 is the finale, the series finale of the show.
Hmm.
And it's like the first time I think I've ever seen them fucking do that.
Interesting.
Netflix is also doing live content, which is also just fucking wild. They're all over the place. But that's why they're so popular, because it's like someone at least gravitates to it.
Well, and I imagine what we were talking about with like, how do you pin down success? I imagine they're kind of in this stage of like throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. Like. Yeah. They're trying all these different release formats, all these different content formats,
and
genres, whatever.
And before we forget, because we definitely will if we keep going on this conversation, the Scargiver as a plot is basically the finale of Seven Samurai. Yeah. It's basically the finale the first film should have been, which is basically the Imperium against our crew on the ship.
In the village.
The first hour is literally just prep. That is really just kind of like, you know, useless to a degree. And then the second hour is just the actual fight itself. And then it ends on a cliffhanger that is just baffling.
Yeah, imagine if Seven Samurai ends with, you know, one remaining samurai being like, but the real fight hasn't even started yet. We're going to take on the shogunate.
It's even lazier than, like, the Pacific Rim Uprising or, like, the Independence Day 2. Like, we're going to take the fight to the... It's even way lazier than that.
Well, because, I mean, there's no real sense of closure. Like, the only thing that gets closed off is they kill the guy that they killed in the first movie.
Yeah.
They kill John Hitler or whatever his name is. And Ed Skrein.
I like how you said his name and you even forgotten. That's how it's gone. That's how it's devolved.
They kill him, but there's no real sense of completion to that because we already did that.
Yeah,
we killed him last time.
And also, the reason why the ending is so much more baffling than, like, you know, a failed sequel tie or, like, kind of like tease is the fact that the film ends on a cliffhanger twist that anyone and their fucking grandmother could have caught, where basically the end of the first film pretty much implies that the princess of the Imperium, before the Imperium was bad, even though the Imperium didn't seem that great when fucking Cary Elwes Emperor was still around, Ellis Emperor was still around, that they had a princess that had the ability to give life to things, a.k.a. the Life Giver.
Right.
And so when the life giver, the seed bearer, good God.
Yeah.
When the life giver gets shot in the second film, and it's implied that there's no way she could have survived from that.
Yeah.
And then the film ends on, guess what? You didn't really kill her. Come on. She's the life giver.
Right.
And that's how they fucking end the second film, is like, there's no way you're getting a three. If you fucking get a three, wow. Like, props to you, but also, like, Jesus Christ. Like, of course she's not dead. You can figure that out from the get-go as soon as she gets introduced in the first film. Like, it's so lazy.
It's the first film spends so much time, like, setting up this kind of greater world conflict with the Imperium and the, you know, Korra's history with them and the shit she did with them. And then this film is so focused on just kind of doing the Seven Samurai finale, it doesn't even address any of that until the very end. So it's like,
yeah,
we don't really get any sense of closure in this overblown third act of the first movie.
Like, it's so fucking lazy that even when its Korra reveals, hey, guess what? I am the Scar Giver. I'm the one that shot the Life Giver. Most of the crew goes, yeah, we kind of caught on to that last film. Like, it's not really that surprising. Which is, like, so fucking lazy. That's so lazy. Because also, I think it's Jaimin, or I think it's fucking, it's Anthony Hopkins' robot. One of the two of them, and I hope I'm saying his name right, Jaimin Hansu. I just know that for years I never knew how to say his name.
Digimon.
That was, and I wish I knew how to say his name, but... because he's a phenomenal actor, and I love it. And I usually love it when he's in most things.
Right. It's Jaimin.
Okay, Jaimin. Okay, good. Because Jaimin is a great actor and deserves all the love and fucking all the work he can get. And it's just a bummer when he's put into this. And he literally is just like, yeah, not only do I know that you're the Scar Giver and that you shot the Life Giver, I also, for some reason, know that the Life Giver isn't dead. And I'm not going to elaborate on that. Stick for the part three, the Life Giver's Piss. I don't know what it's called, but it just is. I don't. It just is kind of. It's tiring. I think it is, because I think genuinely it's tiring, because it's like Snyder is an auteur. The man is, like, it's we can't even deny that, because the man has a specific style. He's been around for long enough. The man gets fucking projects off the ground that you would never expect to get off the ground. And also, a bit of a spoiler.
He keeps getting handed massive projects.
And also, spoiler alert, I don't even know if Andy knows this. This isn't even the last Snyder Netflix production we're getting this year that isn't the director's cut. Because a week or two ago, it was announced that there's going to be a Norse mythology animated series that Netflix is producing with Snyder's name on it. And it also has a fucking good cast attached to it. Yeah, that's fucking Raoul Coley, Hollywood's bad boy himself.
You know what? I'm glad he's finding his way back to animation.
That's the only thing that gives me excitement, is the fact that this is his first animated project in a way since Gahool. And it's like, Gahool had so... You could see a lot of what Snyder's sensibilities as a, you know, as a blocker in terms of, like, scenes, in terms of, like, you know, camera, and it just, like, this shot composition. You could see it so much better in animation. Which, it makes no surprise that, like, some of his best shots in his entire career are when there's less people on screen.
Yeah.
And it's just, it says a lot. And it, when you watch this film, or, like, when we finish The Scar Giver, and then my brain just goes, like, gosh, Sucker Punch is better. I can't fucking lie. Like, Sucker Punch is a better fucking film, and Sucker Punch is an absolute
mess.
A
more interesting
that
film.
Completely misses its girl power film to a toxic degree, and yet it's still more interesting, creative, and fun to watch than fucking anything in this $150 million double feature that is not worth watching at this moment, nor will it make... I don't know if it's even... Like, again, I don't know if it's going to be called Space is Gray or whatever the fuck they're going to call the director's cut. If it's going to be Snyder.
Rebellion is Gray.
Yeah, Rebellion is Gray.
Rebellion,
like, it's,
is Moon.
But it's just like... It just sucks that it's, you know, because if any other fucking auteur went, hey, guess what? Honestly, the only other auteur that could do that is fucking Ridley Scott. Because he literally has a career of just being like, by the way, my, you know, Kingdom in Heaven was shot that, like, was cut to shit. Here's the 3-hour cut that's better. And literally with Napoleon, the fact that people were dunking on Napoleon and the man said, like, yeah, there's a 4-hour cut that's better. Like, and that's all he fucking does. Like, he doesn't give a fuck at a certain point. Yeah. He's like the only other guy that does that. But like in that moment, it doesn't seem like Scott is contractually obligated to make the 4-hour cut.
No.
It's just more like, I'm just saying, like, I've seen other cuts and they're better. While as Snyder is like, no, those cuts are going to get made because studios know what I produce. And that is just hype surrounding things that even if they're not good,
right,
they're just hype or just like they're just more product.
Yeah.
More slop for the trough. Slop. And what you ultimately get with both these films is a frequel episode where we have more interest in talking about the logistics and the statistics and the mindset of a Netflix blockbuster than you actually do breaking down these two films, because there's really not much to break down. It is just shockingly empty across the board. And while I would maybe say Scargiver is a better film because it's shorter and also,
it's
easier
to watch.
To a degree. But even then, like, a lot of the sensibilities that make the first one bad are still very much there in two.
Yeah.
And there is no emotional resonance or commitment to any fucking character.
No.
And it's the type of films where things will just get thrown out left and right. And you will just sit there like fucking Homelander in the theater, just like really taken, just like showing no emotion as twists or like, you know, lore gets dropped. Like, Tarek's a fucking prince on a different planet. They drop that in the first film randomly. And then he gets backstory in two where like they live in like a 20s New York, Brooklyn-esque like fucking world.
Yeah.
And it literally leads to nothing. Like, it's like, oh, there's like a BioShock Infinite world. I don't care. Why the fuck would I care?
What
about
does that have to do with anything?
Yeah. Why? Yeah, this looks vastly different than everything else. Why? Okay,
yeah.
Whatever.
It's just
whatever.
It's senseless, meaningless filmmaking.
It really
utterly worthless.
It is more interesting to just like talk about the fact
how uninteresting it is.
Yeah. And also it's just more interesting to be like, gosh, just imagine if there was an alternate reality where like someone from Rebel Moon did something weird or bad and they Tig Notaro'd the film. That is more objectively interesting than what we actually get here, where it's like they had to CG someone into the fucking shot that wasn't there before. Right. No. What Snyder wanted, Snyder got. And he's still releasing more of it, and we're definitely gonna get more of it later on, and if we don't, it'll really tell how poorly both these films did. But
yeah,
there it is. That's Rebel Moon Part 1 and Part 2, Child of Fire, The Scargiver. There it is. We want to get to fun trilogies again. I want to go back to fun conversations about fun movies.
You know, I out of curiosity, I pulled up the Norse series that Snyder's working on.
Twilight of the Gods.
The first headline I see when I Google it is, Zack Snyder promises, quote, lots of sex in his new animated series.
Yeah.
It's like, great, cool, thank you.
Because that doesn't even unpack. We could spend another hour talking about the fact that Netflix and animation as a relationship is also just so weird and complicated and kind of toxic. So the fact that it's like, while all this is happening, it sounds like Snyder was basically given the reins to make like a Blood of Zeus / Castlevania version of Norse mythology.
Right.
It's just like, of course they're just going to give him the fucking money.
Yeah.
But yeah,
he's already fucking got an office. Just give him a budget. Yeah.
And again, we're not going to talk about Twilight of the Gods because that is a series. Maybe we'll talk about it offhand.
Could pop up on something.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if we talk about it offhand on like an episode, but like we're not going to give it its own thing because that's a series.
Yeah.
But yeah, unfortunately, we wish Rebel Moon 1 and 2 were bad in the way of like a BVS or like, you know, a Sucker Punch where it's just like, oh my gosh, where do I begin?
Fascinatingly atrocious.
This,
but it's just
devoid.
Just empty.
Empty and devoid of anything fascinating.
A husk.
Yeah, don't even watch it, ironically. There's no point to
it. It's not so bad, it's good. It's just fucking bad.
As you know, we will do sometimes when we're just watching something bad, but we're so many hours in and maybe a few beers in. Bad movie.
Bad movies.
That
just becomes
movies.
Our commentary sometimes at a certain point. Bad movies.
I still think about when we watched the Snyder Cut and we were like at hour three, maybe like 3.5 hours of four. And Adam had just like had been talking about how much he disliked the film to the point where he's just laying his head back on the chair going, bad movie. Like he was so tired at that point.
Yeah.
They're like, ah, yeah. But speaking of our friend Adam.
Oh, I thought you were going to say speaking of bad movies.
No, because thankfully
we were
fucking nice enough to ourselves. And also the release schedule was nice enough to ourselves.
Yeah.
So there is actually a film coming out on May 10th that ties into our next trilogy, which will come out May 18th. On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes will come out.
Yeah.
A film I'm very excited for. May has a lot of good open, like, you know, big movies coming out,
yes.
And Kingdom feels like it's going to start it off.
Yes.
Well, technically,
and it's kind of a new chapter extrapolating on the world set about by the last movies.
Yes, which is why our next full-blown trilogy episode is going to be about those films. We are going to be talking about Andy Serkis's Planet of the Apes trilogy with our friend Adam LeClaire, past and future guest.
Yes.
Past, present, and future guest, who is on the Hobbit trilogy episode as well as the Bionicle trilogy episode. We will be talking about 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes, 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and 2017's War for the Planet of the Apes, and preparation for this year's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. That's a lot of the Planet of the Apes that I just said.
I mean, that's the whole series in a nutshell.
Really is.
It's blank of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, don't worry. We're going to have a fun conversation about naming conventions for a Planet of the Apes film.
Yeah.
Because even though both Andy and I really enjoy this trilogy, there are so much fascination surrounding it. What is happening with the Planet of the Apes, you know, franchise before this starts.
The innovations in the technology necessary to make it happen.
And the improvements between films, as well as what the fuck happens in terms of, like, Planet of the Apes media between War and Kingdom, which we can talk about a little bit because it's also fascinating because it's weirdly a drought for most of it, except for like a weird thing here and there.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a lot of fun. Honestly, we, at this point in the recording, we have started our watch through and cannot wait.
We can guarantee at least one pant hoot from Adam, I think. On
absolutely.
The episode.
I think we will all make monkey sounds at least a few times. I think I could make an easy prediction that Adam will clip the mic a few times.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I think
we'll all clip. Yeah,
if it's a coordinated chip event, I think we're really
it is a coordinated chip event already,
and everyone's invited, and it's nearly
you're invited.
Yes, so
dear listener,
so tune in on May 18th when we talk about Andy Serkis's Planet of the Apes trilogy. But until then, I'm Logan Somosh,
and I'm Andy Carr.
Thank you so much for listening. Bye.